Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hey friends, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. This is the weekly highlight reel of videos that I have put out on YouTube. So in case you don't know, you can go over to YouTube and watch all of my videos. The channel is History and Coffee, and you can just search for my name as well, Heather Tesco, History and Coffee, and you will get it. And you can subscribe there. Thank you to the many people who already subscribe. And then what I've started doing is weekly highlight reels of some of the videos that have gone out on YouTube that would be of interest to the podcast listeners as well. So thanks for listening. And you can also, like I said, go over and join me on YouTube, History and Coffee, and search for Heather. And there I am. So let's get right into it. Today, we are going to talk about love dissolving, because it is still love month. I'm going to do this. It's still love month. And we're going to talk about when love goes bad and Tudor divorces, because there were some precedents for even for Henry and his divorces. There had been monarchs who had annulments. Of course, it wasn't divorce as we consider it now. It was more of an annulment. Marriage itself was indissoluble, but you could say that the marriage never took place. So there were precedents for that. There had been a French king who put his wife aside when he wanted to marry someone younger. That had happened just 20, 30 years before Henry's great matter. So there had been precedent for it. And of course, because of what Henry did during his reign, it sort of changed that, mixed with the growing Renaissance humanism and the focus on, you know, this life being important as opposed to just being a practice for the next life, and people deserving to be happy in this life and kind of thinking about what that even meant. It definitely did have an effect, we saw some changes with that throughout the 16th century. So marriage at the beginning of the Tudor period and, you know, through the end, it didn't change that much, but we did start to see some changes. It wasn't just a personal union. It was a sacred institution intertwined with the fabric of social and religious life. This period marked the blend of feudal traditions and, like I said, the emerging Renaissance humanism. It did see marriage as a divine covenant and a societal cornerstone. It was a means to secure alliances, to consolidate power, to ensure social order. The sanctity of marriage was underscored by Protestant theologians and conduct book writers like William Gouge, who said that the family was a little church and a little commonwealth, highlighting its role in mirroring and maintaining the hierarchical and moral order of the wider society. Henry VIII came along with his marriage controversies and his six wives and the schism with the Catholic Church, casting a long shadow over marriage in Tudor England. And it set some unprecedented precedents for marital disillusion. There were some signs that people were watching and people were paying attention and even mimicking what he was doing. Around the same time, there was this fellow in Wales called Edward Griffith. He was a member of the Welsh gentry, and a lot of what he did actually mirrored what Henry did, suggesting a bit of a ripple effect with the king's actions on the realm. So he had three marriages. First, he married a woman called Jane, and then she died, and he married her sister Agnes. But then that was annulled because of matters of consanguinity, where you're related, because he'd been married to the sister, which is kind of what Henry was saying with Catherine having been married to his brother. And then he married another woman called Jane, and there were all these issues that popped up in terms of inheritances and what his children could inherit and who belonged to what, who got what belonged to whom, all of that. But it did reflect a sort of mimicry of the monarch's personal life, hinting at a broader cultural and legal impact of royal marital decisions. The legal grounds for annulment in Tudor England ranged from consanguinity and non-consummation to pre-contracts and underage unions. It reveals the complex interplay between the law, morality, and social norms. Annulments were rare, but they were actually the legal recourse that people had for invalidating a marriage that went against these strictures. So if you married somebody and you found out that they had a pre-contract with somebody else, you could annul that, like we saw with Edward Griffith. There were other similar cases, the marriage between Henry Parker, who was the 10th Baron Morley, and Alice St. John was dissolved due to an alleged pre-contract that she had with Edward Neville, revealed the complexities of the Tudor marriage contract. How did you get your marriage annulled if you wanted to get your marriage annulled and you were living in Tudor England? Well, the church courts is where you would go. They played the pivotal role in adjudicating marital disputes, operating under a legal framework that intertwined religious doctrine with civil law. These courts wielded authority of the church. They were the primary venues for addressing grievances related to marriage, including requests for annulments and separations. You could get a divorce from bed and board. That was a form of legal separation that did not permit remarriage, but it was very narrowly defined, typically limited to cases of adultery or cruelty, but it was a legal mechanism that allowed for people to live apart, couples who had distressing circumstances to live apart while still maintaining that the marriage itself was still valid, but it gave them an opportunity to live apart. So that was what you would do if you were having issues related to your husband being cruel to you or committing adultery or something like that. You would get a divorce from bed and board. But of course, the adjudication of these cases often revealed a stark, guess what, gender bias, because women faced greater scrutiny and were held to higher standards of proof, especially in cases of cruelty or adultery. Because, of course, societal expectation was that women would be chaste, women would be faithful, women would be obedient. So if you weren't those things, it was easier for your husband to say that you weren't living up to your end of the bargain. The man, of course, was supposed to be strong and go out and have affairs and do all of that. I mean, he wasn't really supposed to, but it was much more accepted. So you had a much harder time as a woman proving cruelty or adultery. There was so much of this gender disparity. Even Henry VIII's sister, Margaret Tudor, Queen of Scotland, through her marriage to James IV, found herself entangled in some of this complexity and some of this gender bias. After James IV died, she quickly married Archibald Douglas, the 6th Earl of Angus, and their marriage quickly soured, and she wanted to seek a divorce. This quest was fraught with political implications, and of course, Henry VIII had to step in and say he very much disapproved, because of course he did. And he didn't quite get the irony, but he said that, you know, the marriage was indissoluble and she needed to go back and be a good wife to her husband. So there was a lot of gender bias and a lot of hypocrisy with that. But hey, what else is new, right? Oh, goodness. And we talked about Edward Griffith, mentioned previously. His case illustrates the complexities of these social influences. We have a lot of records of his case. There was a lot of court documents with arguing over these inheritances and who got what and whether marriages were legal or not. So the divorce cases, annulments, and surrounding legal framework in Tudor England reflect a period of tension between personal desires, legal constraints, and societal expectations. The church courts, with their limited grounds for annulment and inherent biases against women, largely highlight the complexity in marital law in an era that valued marriage as a sacred and indissoluble institution. So these narratives that we talked about underscore the intricate balance between individual agency and the broader societal norms that governed the marital relationships in the Tudor period, revealing, of course, that there was a deep interconnectedness between the personal lives, the legal systems, and the social structure. Anne Stanhope is one of these figures that often gets overlooked in Tudor history, the Duchess of Somerset. She was the second wife of the first Duke of Somerset, Edward Seymour, Jane Seymour's brother. She plodded her way through the English court with a mix of intelligence and ambition. During the minority of their nephew, Edward VI, Edward Seymour ascended to the role of Lord Protector, which positioned Anne as one of the most influential women in England at the time. Her story intertwines with pivotal historical events and personalities, offering a unique lens through which to explore the Tudor period. Anne Stanhope was born into the English nobility before 1512. She was the only child of Sir Edward Stanhope and Elizabeth Bouchier. Elizabeth herself was actually a descendant of Thomas Woodstock, who was Edward III's youngest son. So they had a noble ancestry, which gave Anne a sense of destiny and privilege in her life. Her father died in 1511, leaving Anne as the sole heiress to the Stanhope legacy, which undoubtedly would have shaped her ambitions and her future role in the Tudor court. Her upbringing was nestled in the intersections of lineage and loss, preparing her for the challenges and opportunities that lay ahead at the volatile environment of 16th century England. Sometime before March 1535, Anne married Edward Seymour. This was, of course, the beginning of a significant chapter in her life. Edward Seymour was the older brother of Jane Seymour, who was at that point a lady-in-waiting to Anne Boleyn, but would then go on to become the third wife of Henry VIII. And Edward was a rising star in the Tudor court. Following his sister's marriage to the king, Edward's status burgeoned, culminating in his creation as the Duke of Somerset. And then after the death of Henry VIII, when Edward VI was ruling as a minor, he became the Lord Protector. Anne's marriage thrust her into the epicenter of Tudor power politics, her influence peaking alongside her husband's ascendancy. The couple's marital journey was both prolific and tinged with tragedy. They welcomed 10 children, though they did not all survive infancy, which was, of course, very common, sadly. The birth of Edward Seymour, Viscount Beauchamp, and the subsequent Earl of Hertford underscored the continuity of the Seymour lineage, yet the early deaths of their first children, including the namesake of Queen Jane, cast shadows of sorrow over their domestic life. These personal trials unfolded against the backdrop of Edward Seymour's volatile political career, with Anne's role as his consort amplifying her presence and influence within the royal court. Anne Stanhope's tenure as the de facto First Lady of England during her husband's Lord Protectorship was actually marked by her formidable ambition, and there was a lot of court drama. Notably, there was rivalry with Catherine Parr over court precedence. Catherine Parr, of course, would have been the widow, the Dowager Queen, but then she married Thomas Seymour, which made her sisters-in-law. Again, it was all very related. that she married the younger Seymour brother, Thomas. So Edward Seymour and Thomas Seymour had their own rivalries. And then, of course, Anne Stanhope and Catherine Parr are involved with that. So now Catherine Parr is the Dowager Queen, but she also just married the younger brother. And Anne Stanhope is the wife of the Protector. Anne insisted on claiming superiority over the Queen Dowager based on her husband's regency, which underscored her assertive personality and her desire for recognition within the royal hierarchy. This contention reached its zenith when Anne refused to carry Catherine's train, which was a very bold move, to say the least, which publicly displayed the depth of their enmity. The zenith of Anne's influence, however, coincided with the very precarious nature of Edward Seymour's power. He was growing into an autocrat. He was taking on the role of the king himself, and the ensuing kind of political drama led to his eventual downfall. Both Anne and Edward were imprisoned in the Tower of London, a stark reversal of fortune that tested Anne's resilience, to say the least. Despite the grim circumstances, her spirit remained unbroken. Her release from the Tower, while Edward faced execution, marked the beginning of a new chapter of endurance and adaptation for her, showcasing her ability to navigate the treacherous waters of Tudor politics, even in the age of personal tragedy. Following the tumultuous events that culminated in Seymour's execution, Anne Stanhope actually navigated her widowhood with a resilience that mirrored her earlier life. Her second marriage to Francis Newdigate, a former steward to her late husband, signified a quieter phase of her life, but she remained a figure of considerable interest within the Tudor court. This period was less about political ambition and more about ensuring the well-being and advancement of her children, who continued to play significant roles in the socio-political landscape of England. The romantic entanglements of her children, particularly the clandestine marriage of her son Edward to Catherine Grey, who was a niece of Henry VIII, sister to the ill-fated Lady Jane Grey, brought Anne back into the swirl of intrigue. This alliance was formed in the shadows of political ambition and personal affection, and it resulted in the couple's imprisonment in the Tower of London, echoing, of course, Anne having been there herself with her first husband, Edward. Despite these challenges, Anne's later years were characterized by matriarchal oversight of her family's fortunes, navigating the complex Tudor succession and the shifting allegiances of the English court with a seasoned eye for survival and legacy. Anne Stanhope's influence extended beyond the political arena and into the realms of culture and religion. As patron of the arts, she supported the intellectual and artistic vibrancy of the Tudor court, contributing to its cultural legacy. Her engagement with the Protestant Reformation reflected a moderate approach to religious reform, in contrast to more radical contemporaries like Anne Eskew. This nuanced position allowed her to navigate the shifting landscape of Henry VIII and Edward VI's reign, embodying the complexities of Tudor religiosity and its impact. Anne Stanhope actually made it until 1587. She passed away at Hanworth Palace after decades of navigating the intricacies of the Tudor political world. Her final resting place in Westminster Abbey, among the pantheon of England's historical figures, underscores her significance. Anne's legacy is that of a woman who, with unwavering determination and keen intellect, charted her own course through the perilous waters of Tudor England, influencing both its political and cultural landscapes. Her life story enriches our understanding of the period, highlighting the agency and resilience of women in a male-dominated historical narrative. Reevaluating Anne Stanhope's historical footprint reveals a figure of considerable complexity and capability, far more than merely the spouse of a powerful man. Her story invites us to appreciate the multifaceted roles that women played in shaping the Tudor period, often operating within constrained spaces yet exerting significant influence. Anne's life was marked by personal resilience, political savvy, and cultural patronage, and it challenges us to consider the broader narratives of women in history, recognizing their contributions amidst the tumultuous and transformative times in which they lived. Thanks so much for listening to this week's YouTube highlights. Remember, you can go over and subscribe, History and Coffee, Heather Tesco, you will find me there. And we'll be back again next week with more highlights from what went out on YouTube throughout the week. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Blow, northern wind, send for baby sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.